everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Continuing with our series of conversations with remarkable minds, we're going to be talking with Dr. Alan Wallace by Skype. The theme is why understanding the differences between consciousness, the mind, and brain is so critical to avoid falling into scientific materialism. Dr. Alan Wallace is one of our leading voices exploring the interface between modern science, meditation, Buddhism, and spirituality, and Tibetan medicine. He's the founding director of the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies that has a mission to apply rigorous scientific methodology and inquiry into contemplative practices and teaches and lectures worldwide. While studying at the University of Göttingen in Germany, Alan left for India and was ordained by the Dalai Lama as a monk, and he holds degrees in physics and philosophy of science at Amherst College, a doctorate in religious studies at Stanford University. He has taught at the University of California at Santa Barbara for several years, and for the past 33 years, Alan has been a frequent translator and contributor for meetings between the Dalai Lama and the world-renowned scientist. He has written and translated over 40 books dealing with the science of mind and consciousness, and Western scientific philosophy, lucid dreaming, many commentaries and translations of the Tibetan Buddhist text. And some of his research on meditation has been published in peer-reviewed scientific journals. Among some of this noteworthy publication would be Mind in the Balance, Meditation in Science, Buddhism, and Christianity. Also, Phantoming the Mind, Inquiry and Insight into the Vajra Essence, and Dreaming Yourself Awake. His personal website is alanwallace.org. And the Institute, a separate would be Consciousness Studies, is sbinstitute.com. Nice to have you with us today, Alan.
My pleasure to join you. Thank you, Gary.
Somewhere along the highway of Western civilization's evolution, we seem to have taken the wrong exit. What used to be regarded as the mystery and awe and wonder of life was cast aside, and in its place is a very cold, rational, objective, and materialistic view of not only the world we live in, but ourselves. And this has become a dominant paradigm in many of the sciences, particularly the biological sciences and neuroscience and medicine. I remember interviewing a physician for a documentary film, and he said that in medical school, you begin with a corpse. Then you investigate the causes of death, the illnesses, and later you're taught treatments, which are inevitably drugs or surgery. In other words, medical students begin with a machine that is broken down. And there are many scientists who accept this as the only feasible worldview. I know you've spoken on this subject before, but what was the historical turning point, the wrong exit taken that has led us on this trajectory of scientific materialism? Take your time, please. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. Well, you're raising enormously important and complex issues here. If we go back to what I regard, and many people regard, as the origin of modern science, not so much the Copernicus, because he was purely a theoretician, a mathematician, but Galileo. According to Einstein, Galileo was the true father of modern science, and I think there are many good reasons for accepting that view. But it's often we may overlook the fact that Galileo, as a youth, was trained in a contemplative monastery, quite a famous one, in Tuscany. And he was very drawn to the contemplative life. And the whole point of that was to know the mind of God from within by turning inwards in the Augustinian tradition, the Benedictine tradition. And he was very drawn to it. But after several years of such contemplative training as a youth, an adolescent, then his father was no longer willing to support him there, pay for his contemplative training, and told him to come out of the monastery and, make a living. So then he went to the University of Pisa, he studied mathematics, and the rest is history. But this points to an issue that is very crucial, and that is Galileo was a profoundly religious person. And instead of being able to seek the mind of God by looking within, he followed the writings or was inspired by the writings of a great Roman Catholic, polymath, Nicholas of Cusa, who was a direct assistant or an emissary of the Pope. And he was a philosopher and a mystic and an astronomer and a jurist and so forth. And Nicholas of Cusa, we're going back to the 15th century here, and I'll try to be concise, said there are two ways. He proposed two ways to know the mind of God. One is the traditional Christian contemplative way of looking within and penetrating through, breaking through the confines of the human soul to the infinite mind of God. This was time-tested, very well researched or explored. But Nicholas of Cusa, the polymath that he was, suggested there's another way, and that is by looking outwards to creation and indirectly understanding the mind of the Creator by way of the creation. And Galileo, having no longer the option to follow the traditional course, then turned to mathematics, turned to what was then called natural philosophy. And so he was driven by a deeply theological or religious impulse to know the mind of the Creator by way of the creation, and to know the mind of God by way of his language. And Galileo and generations of scientists since him have regarded mathematics as the language of God. And when this became secularized in the mid-19th century, mathematics became the language of nature. But there's a theme here that I've read from an outstanding historian on, what was it? It was, I'm trying to remember, it doesn't matter the title. The point here being, though, from Galileo up till the time of Darwin, all of Western science was thoroughly embedded within a Christian worldview. Kepler was a theologian, Galileo had been trained as a contemplative, Newton was a theologian, and the list goes on and on, right up into the 20th century. And so it was couched within Christianity, and for many people there was a religious motivation to it. Then we find Darwin, who was raised as a Christian, of course, and with his spectacular research, his brilliant theory. But then from his research, I think, from that and various personal issues in his life, he just found untenable, unbelievable, the classic portrayal or belief in God as promoted by the Church of England. And he lost his faith in God. And then Darwin's bulldog, the brilliant biologist Thomas H. Huxley, also became utterly disillusioned with Church of England, basically, and then more broadly Christianity. Then it was from that turning point, the 1860s, that science, natural philosophy that came to be called science, which was completely embedded within Christianity. So the meaning of existence, the meaning of reality as a whole was all to be found in Christianity. And then science was serving that. So again, philosophy is the handmaiden of religion, of theology. So that was the widespread view until this turning point. And that turning point was this view in antagonism, kicking away from the closed-mindedness, the dogmatism, sometimes the sheer stupidity of theologians who were closed-minded and couldn't consider the possibility that species evolve and so forth. It was from that point that this brilliant popularizer and writer and, one could say, almost evangelist for science, and I mean this in a good way, Thomas H. Huxley, but he did at times promote science as being the only way to understand the natural world. And it was at that point, and it ignited like wildfire, as he popularized science as a viable profession. He encouraged it to be taught in the schools. He encouraged money to come for scientific research. It was at that point that natural philosophy became science, and science almost defined itself by focusing entirely on the natural, seeking to understand all of nature within a naturalistic framework, which then became a materialistic framework. So that was a turning point. And William James, who received as the great pioneer of Western psychology, received his medical training during the closing decades, or about the 1860s, 1870s, and he was already being taught exactly what you just mentioned, Gary, that the mind is simply a function of the body, and the body is simply a machine. And so it started there, and it drove him into, William James, it drove him into such depression this view that we really have no free will at all. We're just machines. We're only physical. And we're physical machines responding to physical sensations or stimuli. This drove him into almost a catatonic state of depression. Coming straight out of his medical training at Harvard Medical School. And he managed to bootstrap himself out of that utterly debilitating depression by being inspired by a French philosopher named Renouvier that said the first act of free will is to assert or to affirm that you have it. And so this was a counterculture that he tried to arouse together with Wilhelm Wundt, Edward Titchener, and other pioneers of modern psychology. But in 1910, then that whole movement of introspection, of taking first-person experience seriously and shunning the reductionism of materialism, that was squelched by the rise of behaviorism that said, never mind subjective experience, never mind introspection. We'll learn everything we need to learn about the mind simply by studying behavior. And mind is nothing more than a predisposition to respond to stimuli, to engage in behavior. So that was the turning point. It began in the 1860s, really picked up very swift momentum. And then in terms of the mind sciences, that really began in the year that William James died, and that was 1910. And it's frankly the cognitive sciences, starting with behaviorism, going on to cognitive psychology, going on to cognitive neuroscience. It's never recovered. It's never recovered from the smothering influence, both ideological and methodological, of materialism. And the result of this is over the last century or 110 years, there's been no actual progress in fathoming the nature of the relationship of mind and body. Within the medical tradition, we have this plethora of psychopharmaceutical drugs, and many of them are very effective in suppressing the symptoms of psychological disease, and often with side effects that need more drugs to suppress those symptoms. But to this point, and I've asked many mental health care professionals on this point, and it's always one answer, there's not even one psychopharmaceutical drug that cures any mental disease at all. And so this materialism has kept us in the dark about the nature of the mind, the mind-body relationship, the nature of consciousness, the role of mind in nature, and the actual causes of mental distress, and the actual causes of genuine well-being, or what the Greeks call eudaimonia. So I applaud and I appreciate, celebrate the tremendous advances of science over the last 400 years, over the last 150 years since Darwin and Thomas Huxley. But I've seen no upside whatsoever to the smothering influence, the straitjacket of this metaphysical ideology or dogma of materialism that has hampered us from understanding the nature of reality as a whole, flattening it to a two-dimensional surface of matter and energy being the source of everything, and has smothered our understanding of the nature of the mind and how to understand and treat mental illness. So I'm a great advocate of science, but I'm extremely critical of this scientific materialism, and the sooner it becomes a bad memory, the happier I will be.
Okay, that was a very insightful opening discussion. I've written and commented a lot about the skeptic movement, about 72 articles, to challenge the legitimacy or lack of legitimacy of Wikipedia being an actual encyclopedia, such as the Encyclopedia Britannica. Mm-hmm. And this was partly personal. You said that there's been no advancement. In 1970, I became a junior scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, a very orthodox place with its cancer and pain research, mainly looking for drugs. And it was supported by the pharmaceutical industry and foundations, and had a lot of noble people working there. And I was a person working on behavior. Dr. Lawrence Lachan was also there, and he well known for predicting the outcome of cancer in non-cancerous patients based upon whether they felt loved or appreciated. No one had done that study before, not even Hans Selye.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a small town. My mother was just a gentle person with an abundance of common sense, but she had a gift. In the South, it's called being a sensitive. Mm-hmm. And you're able to understand what's happening in someone without them telling you. And what you do, you don't tell them what you see. You tell them what they should do so what you see doesn't happen. So you try to encourage them always with positive change. I had that gift. As a young child, it scared me because of what I would see and then what would happen. But my mother said, don't be afraid of this gift. It's meant to help you help others. Now, here I am years later at the Institute of Pi Biology, and I decided to do an experiment. I put the word out that I was looking for people who felt that they had the ability through whatever means, through prayer, meditation, to help reverse cancer. And to make it more interesting in this case, to eliminate the nocebo-placebo effect, it wasn't on humans, it was on mice. And so about 50 people signed up. There was a televangelist, Catherine Coleman, and Olga Wirl from Great Britain. There was the famous healer, Harry Edwards, and he was the head of the Spiritual Healing Association of Great Britain. But there's also Dr. Dolores Krieger, head of nursing at New York University Nursing School, and Dr. Thomas Kruth, the Order of St. Luke, and Dr. Morton Jacobs, who was famous for being the chiropractor with the healing hands, and the Dr. Audrey Carger, and Rabbi Abraham Wiseman. Now, those I mentioned because of the 50 people, these were able to reverse ascites tumors 7 out of 7 times over a 2-year period in the mice that they were working with. And they couldn't handle the mice. There was always 2 attendants there to watch. And they would engage generally in quiet meditation. And at the end of 2 years, for the first time, we had scientific hard evidence that a phenomena occurred that would have required an energy transfer, whether it was through prayer or intent. You were able to take a person, even if they believed they were a channel, and use that energy to impact a creature, a little sentient being like these mice. And I was able to get this published, and Dr. Rollo May and Dr. Stanley Krippner and some others who were doing similar research communicated, and it became like the hot spot for years to do kind of psi research or energy medicine research. It was done quietly, but we had a lot of interest. And the bottom line was, it showed that we can impact another human being or an animal in their energy field. And I felt at one point when I was being interviewed on television about this, I felt embarrassed by the fact that I had to say we had to do a scientific experiment to know what every mother in the world has ever known about having a baby and what it takes to nurture, and everyone who's touched someone's hand that they love and prayed, and how someone knows something's wrong even when there's no proper evidence that something's wrong, where you say, what's wrong? Nothing's wrong. I know something's wrong. Now, I give this as background because an entire group of defenders of the orthodox Newtonian linear gate of science and medicine says none of this is real, that prayer doesn't work. These are all atheists. They're carrying forward a lot of the work of those who believed in strict evolutionary principles, that there's nothing magnanimous involved, nothing beyond that. So that said, today, if you want to know about energy healing, you would go to Wikipedia, or you Google, and it'll take you to Wikipedia, and Wikipedia has the skeptics, and they control everything on this topic. And these people espouse an extreme reductionist view of the mind and body and psyche and health. What I find rather interesting is that the majority of the leaders in the skeptic movement have professions in the biological sciences and less so in physics, particularly quantum physics, or mathematics and engineering. Seemingly how these two groups approach and understand both scientific certainty and uncertainty is different. I imagine their methodologies for arriving at their particular truths are at some variance as well, especially when it comes to how one quantifies and interprets results. And of course, the biological and medical professions only look at biomolecules, whereas physicists are peering into other phenomena behind the bodies and brain's molecular interactions that have its own particular laws. Are you able to account for this distinction where those involved in the evolutionary biology, neuroscience, cognitive psychology, and behavioralism are missing essential observations or principles that physicists would readily understand. For example, skeptics dismiss energy or mind-body medicine, hence acupuncture, meditation, faith-based healing completely is denigrated as pseudoscience or quackery. And is this simply because they do not understand energy, so it doesn't fit into their preconceived opinions? And finally, Dr. Dolores Krieger had so much success at healing her rats that she founded Therapeutic Touch, which is taught in every nursing school in America, as well as around the world, from that study. Back to you.
This is wonderful, Gary. Really. So enlightening what you're sharing with me, and I'm delighted to listen to you. I think I would just want to add a footnote to the comment I made earlier, that from the time of, well, really the founding of the modern scientific discipline of psychology in the 1870s, preceded just 10 years earlier by the rapid domination of science by the dogma, the reductionism of materialism, which in fact is not scientific at all. I like this parallel, and that is, there is nothing scientific about materialism any more than there's anything religious about religious fundamentalism. And in fact, the two are antagonistic to each other. Materialism suppresses freedom of inquiry within the scientific community, and fundamentalism does the same thing for religion. It makes it look stupid. And for a person who is not a scientist, but has deep religious convictions, or the type of insights that you've been sharing here, insofar as science is dominated by the reductionism, materialism, science looks stupid and something just to be rejected. And of course, we're seeing this in the political arena today with catastrophic results. I'm not going to elaborate on that, but I think it's pretty self-evident what I'm saying is, to a large degree, a whole political party has aligned itself with closed-minded, frankly stupid religion, and then abandoning science because it's affiliated with materialism that seems fundamentally at odds with any type of non-reductionistic view, like what you've been sharing, but also religious believers around the world. So just then on that basis, just one point out of historical respect, and that is Newton himself was a profoundly religious person. So when we speak of Newtonian science, the materialists have whitewashed. They've given a facelift to Newton to make him one of their own. But in fact, for the last 25 years of Newton's life, he devoted more time and energy to writing theology than he did to doing scientific research. He was something of a mystic and absolutely not a reductionist or materialist. That happened centuries later. He was writing in the late 17th century. It was almost 200 years later that his science was embedded within a completely materialistic framework in which, to use the phrase, the universe was causally closed. And this came out of Helmholtz in the 1850s, 1860s, the conservation of mass and energy. And in his classical view, therefore, there are no non-physical influences on the physical universe, and therefore mind is either physical or it's irrelevant. But Newton was not of that mindset at all. This was a makeover. And his fascination with alchemy, his dedication to religion, to his own Christianity, is hushed up and quieted by the materialists who would like to have him in their gang. Because as Einstein said, Newton was probably the greatest scientist of all time in terms of Western civilization. Moving forward, though, there is a neuroscientist who I've gotten to know a little bit personally, but I've read and listened to him extensively, and that's Donald Hoffman at the University of California at Irvine. And he has answered your question as a mainstream, very, very good neuroscientist who completely rejects materialism. He has made this comment, and it's a direct response to your question, Gary, and that is, he said, we as a profession, the neuroscientists, we are living within, in terms of our understanding of physics. You can get a PhD in neuroscience and never study any 20th century physics at all, unless it's just a light flyover. And so all of modern cognitive science, and that includes modern neuropsychiatry, is embedded in 19th century physics. Because they're simply assuming, well, no person with a brain is moving around at relativistic speeds, and quantum mechanics, they're simply assuming works only for elementary particles that are protected from the surrounding environment in a quantum system and therefore completely irrelevant. These were two massive assumptions that nothing that happened in the 20th century in physics has any relevance for biological sciences in general, for neurosciences in particular, which began in the 1960s. And so Donald Hoffman comments, and I paraphrase him closely, that even to this day, 2020, cognitive psychologists, mainstream academic cognitive psychologists, cognitive neuroscientists, are simply assuming, well, we're perfectly content with the worldview of the 19th century, which is classical, it's mechanistic, and nothing influences the brain that is not itself physical. And so they simply brush off, ignore, but don't even know about, through tremendous insights, especially over the last 20, 30 years, with John Archibald Wheeler, and Andre Linde, and Anton Seilinger, and Stephen Hawking, for that matter, and then my favorite of the real groundbreakers, people doing groundbreaking research, is the physicist Christopher Fuchs at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, who are emphasizing more and more explicitly not only the role of the observer in the natural world, but the role of consciousness, that it cannot be reduced to matter. But this comes out of cutting-edge physics. But biologists, for the great majority, apart from Donald Hoffman, David Presty at the University of California, Berkeley, who has a PhD in physics and is very well versed in neuroscience and clinical psychology, apart from a handful of neuroscientists here or there, the great majority don't know what happened in the 20th and 21st century in physics, and therefore they're just resting on the metaphysical assumptions of the late 19th century. So this accounts for it. So just in a summary here, in terms of materialism, I think the people who most undermine the worldview, the metaphysical dogma of materialism, are in fact physicists, that discipline that has deeper insight in the nature of matter than any other discipline. They tend to turn out to be the least materialistic, and they're just taking the rug out. That is, there is no objective space and time existing out there in the objective world in and of itself. Elementary particles don't exist in and of themselves. And as Richard Feynman said, the Nobel laureate, we don't even know really what energy is. We just know it's conserved. But if we ask, what is it actually, as something objective out there in the physical world, we don't know. So the most devastating critique of materialism in terms of the world as a whole comes from physics. And then the discipline that is most deeply called into question, the materialistic reduction of mind to brain, are actually the people studying that. That is a 150-year failure, as Donald Hoffman points out, for mainstream cognitive psychology, neuroscience, evolutionary biology. The discipline that most undermines the materialistic reduction of mind to brain are, in fact, the neuroscientific and psychological communities themselves, which, according to Donald Hoffman, have made no progress in actually understanding the relationship between mind and brain, because they're simply assuming the mind is nothing other than what the brain does without ever questioning that. And likewise, they're simply assuming that consciousness is generated solely by the brain, but with no compelling evidence, but they never question it. They're more like religious fundamentalists than they are open-minded critical scientists. And the final point then, and this is where I edit my own words, and that is when I, quoting Donald Hoffman and knowing a fair amount of modern physics, when I say there's been no progress, well, this is in mainstream academia, and according to the mainstream media, and according to Wikipedia, I very rarely check my own entry of B. Allen Wallace and Wikipedia, but I see somebody's trashing me, and now I know who, you know, because they keep on misrepresenting what I say and then ridiculing me, and I don't mind that. But now you've just cast light on this, because I wonder why are they misrepresenting what I'm saying and then refuting the straw horse, you know? And so now I know. But the neuroscientists have done more to show that their own reductionism of mind to body is false. The pharmaceutical industry has shown that it's false, having not produced one medicine that cures any mental disease. And they've made, as I said, no progress in mind-body relationship, simply that there are correlations, but they don't have any idea what is the nature of the correlations, and how, as an example you gave, how does a placebo effect even work? The fact that it's called a placebo effect is already profoundly misleading, because it suggests the effect comes from the placebo, which is a sugar tablet, which is crazy. It should be called the effect of the mind, or the effect of expectation and faith and belief and anticipation and hope. That's the effect. But those are not physical, and so therefore they don't call it a mind effect or a faith effect. They call it a placebo effect, which is really a ruse. But progress has been made, as you're very well known, but it's still largely being ignored by scientific journals, the scientific community, by academia, mainstream academia, and by the media. So it's really time for a change, because you know of so much research that has been done. And I know at the University of Virginia, the Division of Perceptual Studies, I know the people there. They've made a number of very important discoveries that are almost uniformly ignored, or when they're not ignored, disparaged by the mainstream academia. Dean Radin, the Institute of Noetic Sciences in California, there's a group at the University of Edinburgh. They're doing marvelous work. They're making progress, and they're being shunned, ridiculed, and ignored by the mainstream academia, scientific community, and media, and government agencies such as the National Institute of Mental Health, which has as its fundamental creed, all mental diseases are nothing more than brain dysfunction. And they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars coming with more drugs, ignoring the very possibility that physical diseases like cancer that you've mentioned, or depression and so forth, in fact, do not originate from brain dysfunction. They have correlates in brain function, but they originate from life, which we all know. But materialists blind us to what we all know, that depression can come from a myriad of reasons, and the brain just tags along. So these are important issues, Gary. Thank you for raising them.
Alan, I'm going to take it a little deeper here. I'm going to send you, a little later today, a 19-minute video clip. And I would like for you to try to get back to me when you have a chance and tell me what you believe happened. I've been doing retreats maybe once a year for a week or two in different locations. For the last 10 years, it's been down in Texas, up in East Texas. And there people learn how to change their diet to a healthy plant-based diet, exercise, meditate, enjoy life in a green way, meaning meditating with trees and water, just being appreciative of silence in the moment.
Yeah.
Something that you're familiar with for decades. But these are new experiences for city people and getting out into nature. And I tell them, nothing's expected of you. Just remain in silence as much as you can. We eat in silence. They're juicing. They do yoga, meditation. And with a small group, anywhere from 5 to 10 each retreat, I work with energy. That's all. And I say, do not ask me what I'm doing. If you benefit, it's a gift. I'm one of those people who believe if you have a gift, you give a gift.
Sure.
And I do not explain it. Now, what you're going to see in the 19 minutes, you're going to see 5 people. They all came for 2 weeks. Now, let me give you just 2 examples of the people who were there. One is a man from Atlanta, Georgia, 70-year-old, African-American, and an economist. And he had end-stage COPD. His pulmonologist said nothing more could be done. And then his oncologist said that he had end-stage leukemia. Now, he had already been to this hospice center where his father died of leukemia and his 2 brothers died of COPD. And he knew what was in store for him because he was there to see them through the end of their life. And in the last moment, instead of coming to that hospice center, he came down to Texas. He could barely breathe. When I would see him, he was bent over and had a hard time walking, and he had to have oxygen. He had no energy. And so for 3 days, he attended workshops and did everything. I saw no improvement. There was also a young African-American gentleman, 32 years old, who was there with his mother, and he was shaking so vigorously that he had to keep his eyes closed because his eyes would go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. He had tremors in his eyes. And it meant that when he opened them, he was nauseous. And his hands shook, his whole body shook. And he had been this way for 16 years. And his mother felt nothing could hurt, might as well see if anything can help. There was also a woman, young woman, African-American. She was in her 20s, and she had advanced multiple sclerosis so bad that if she walked a half a block from her apartment to the subway, she would have to go to bed for 6 hours. And she couldn't put one foot in front of the other without falling over. She couldn't raise a leg in the air. She'd fall. Now, there were several others, but when I saw the results on the last day that people were there, on a Friday, I simply asked the people, you all want to go for a walk? So 7 of them said, yeah, we'll go for a walk. So we went on this bucolic country road, and we began to walk. And it was just a mile course, a mile up, a mile back. And I had little golf carts with some doctors and nurses along the way. In case they got tired, they'd just get in the cart, we'd bring them back. And we had a table set up for some juices and even got a massage table down there with our masseuse in case they got any cramps in their legs, we'd massage them out. At the end of that day, the one gentleman with two terminal illnesses was able to walk fast, power walk, nonstop, 30 miles. That's an ultra marathon. The young lady with multiple sclerosis, a marathon. A morbidly obese woman with a very high obesity level and diabetes and blood sugar and blood pressure, a marathon. The gentleman who was confined to a wheelchair, no more eye tremors, no more hand tremors. He was steady as a rock. And a gentleman, 95 years of age, who had come with his head down with Alzheimer's, couldn't take care of himself, couldn't feed himself, couldn't shave himself, couldn't brush his teeth. He was answering questions that I would give to the general lecture group, and he was correct, and he was also joking. He had returned his sense of humor. He was dancing with his wife, and he had clarity, and he said for the first time in years, he went to the bathroom, took care of all of his needs himself. And a guy who had lifelong depression, serious, debilitating depression, said he felt as if this gigantic dark cloud had lifted from him. He felt exuberant. And by the way, that was over a year ago, and he still maintains that exuberance. Now, I called my cinematographer who came down, and we filmed this. As you can see, there's no coaching. They're just asked, tell us your experience over the last 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Now, they had remarkable improvements with medically in irreversible conditions. There's nothing at all in the whole medical paradigm that could help in him because they'd all gone through orthodox medicine. This was their first experience at something kind of natural. Well, the questions that I got was, which nutrients made the difference? And I thought, my God, they didn't get this at all.
No.
Now, I've done this to probably 10,000 people. And we have it filmed. We have the before and afters. And yet, scientists and physicians, including physicians who've come. I even had an oncologist named Kiefer from University of Pennsylvania, oncologist, 22 years, a professor, who came because she had a friend who was dying, a patient, who she was fearful would die on the plane. But once she got there, and I gave her some energy work, she completely reversed her position, and by the time she left, in 2 weeks, she was up, she was happy, energized, and Kiefer couldn't explain it. And I said, remember, don't ask me if there's an improvement, a reversal, just think of it as a gift. And she comes from India. So she has studied the Vedas and other texts of other ways of healing and other ways of understanding disease, much like a traditional Chinese person would or an Ayurvedic person would. They look at the body, they look at disease differently.
Sure.
Well, nobody could understand what happened. They saw phenomena happening, but when a group of scientists, anti-aging scientists, saw it, they said, well, you must have changed their molecular configuration in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, my goodness, you think it's in what they did. It's not in what they did. It's what they allowed. It's mm-hmm. all about changing your perception through energy to change your reality, in effect to liberate your internal healer instead of keeping him cloistered in the closet of our psychic fear chamber. Your thoughts on that, please.
Number one, simply sheer delight and appreciation, but not surprise, because the type of work you've been doing, and of course everyone is unique, so I'm not going to say you're like such and such and such, because every healer is unique, but of course you're perfectly aware you're not the only energy healer or spiritual healer on the planet. What is remarkable is the institutions, the communities that are dominated by materialism, and this is most of academia and most of science, they're the only ones who don't know about this, Gary. In Tibet, traditional, you know, I'm very familiar with Tibetan culture. Of course they knew about this. There was nothing unusual about this. This was normal. In India, classical India, 5,000-year-old civilization, nothing unusual. China, nothing unusual. Southeast Asia, nothing unusual. South America, Africa, they all knew about this. The only civilization that doesn't know about this, remains ignorant and therefore ridicules it, marginalizes, or just throws it out, is those communities dominated by materialism, were the only ones kept in the dark. But these people are the ones that control academia, control funding by the national government, state governments, and they control the media and they control the scientific community to a very large extent. But we're the odd men out. That community, are they are the New Agers. Because all the other civilizations on the planet, they all knew about what you're doing. They would not raise an eyebrow. They would delight in it. And they had variations on that theme in all the major continents and civilizations of the planet. So those are my first observations. But you've used the word energy, and it's a perfect term. I don't know of any better one. But I have studied physics, and my undergraduate thesis at Amherst College was all about energy. And so I became rather familiar with it in a straight, you know, mainstream physicist context. And I know the history of it as well. I looked into the history, the philosophy of scientific understanding of energy. And what you're doing was counted out in the mid-19th century, again, on the basis of good science, the conservation of mass, matter, and energy. But when they thought of energy, they thought of only the kind of energies that are familiar to modern science, electromagnetic, gravitational, thermal, and so forth, kinetic energy, and so forth. And any other kind of energy they didn't know about was then ridiculed. So it was with this conservation of matter and energy, mathematically formulated by Hermann von Helmholtz, that any other kind of energy of what you're talking about, and we call it energy, yes, but no physicist would understand or be able to classify what you're regarding as energy within their framework. It's not electromagnetic, it's not thermal, it's not gravitational, it's not kinetic, it's not mechanical, not and so forth and so on. But everybody else knew about this. So as you well know, Gary, for thousands of years in India, they call this prana. And prana was no more, how do you say, esoteric or something that would arouse skepticism than viruses for us or bacteria for us. Who's ever seen a virus? Who's ever seen a bacteria? Very few people. But nobody in his right mind doubts their existence and that they can cause illness. And there are bacteria, of course, without which we couldn't live. The hundreds of millions or billions, whatever, in our gastrointestinal system, without them we couldn't digest food. But not many people have seen bacteria, either the harmful or the helpful sort. So in India for thousands of years, it was prana. In Tibet for the last at least 1,200 years, it's called lung. In China, it's called qi. In Japan, it's called ki. And throughout all the other civilizations in Asia, they all knew about what you're doing. But it's the arrogance, the colonialism, the imperialism of Eurocentric civilization that, number one, colonized almost all of these countries. The Chinese communists, with their atheism and materialism, completely smothered Tibetan civilization, which was immensely rich and still is, despite the genocide that took place there. So many of the colonial powers invaded and desecrated Chinese civilization. The British and the Portuguese, but primarily the British, dominated Indian culture. And so that even in Indian universities today, and I've spent years living in India, even in the institutes of, Institute of Technology, the IIT, Indian Institute of Technology, and the major universities of India, they largely overlook their own heritage because they were so dominated by the British to disparage and to dismiss their own 5,000-year-old civilization in favor of materialism. So we need another category. When you speak of energy healers, and I know of others that are wonderfully effective, we can call it energy, but what it really is, it's what was energy was understood to be before materialism came along, prana, chi, lung, and so forth. And it's as real as anything else. It just can't be, thus far, cannot be measured objectively using the current instruments of technology, or it has been, it's always poo-pooed, dismissed, and so forth. And so what you're doing is something very ancient. The materialist would say what you're doing or claims you're doing is New Age, and how can we know what's really going on in terms of nutriments and molecules? But this just shows how tiny this worldview is. I think of a materialistic worldview is living inside a peanut shell compared to the whole of reality that covers so much more than what is understood as material or physical in the modern world. And a major pointer to this is the fact that in terms of modern cosmology and the movements of galaxies throughout, throughout space, physicists, cosmologists are able to account for only 6% of the matter and energy or the forces in the known universe, and they're attributing all the rest of that to dark matter and dark energy. But what is dark energy? They don't know, but of course they can give it a term they're familiar with that categorizes it as physical. But dark energy, what is it actually? They don't know. They just know there are forces for which they have no explanation. These repulsive forces, they call it dark energy. And then there's far more attraction in the universe than can be accounted for, so they attribute that to dark matter. But they always come back to dark matter and energy, which now comprises 96, or is responsible for 94% of the forces in the known universe. And they're calling them matter and energy, but they don't know anything about it. So they don't really even know it's matter and energy. They just know they can't account for it. And the categories that they're familiar with that make sense to them are matter and energy. But what it really means is 94, 96%, something like that, of the forces in the universe are completely unaccounted for, cannot be explained in terms of the modern materialistic paradigm. It says everything comes from configurations of matter and energy. So once again, as I said before, the disciplines that are most undermining the reduction of all of reality to configurations of matter and energy are, in fact, physicists. And so what you're doing is marvelous. I mean, but I don't think it's miraculous, and I don't think it's supernormal. It is normal for people who have a broader worldview than the straitjacket of materialism.
I appreciate that. Thank you. You speak a lot about how modern science and our civilization, for that matter, disregards subjective experience and argues that it has no real value. And yet, I'm sure when you conduct your meditation retreats, people have profound subjective experiences, and most important, these experiences have value and meaningfulness for each individual person. I certainly witnessed this repeatedly during my health retreats, and especially with people with very severe illnesses, including advanced cancer and Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis. Simply observing what is quantifiable or objective in the changes in their health is insufficient. In fact, I consider many of these changes symptomatic of much more profound changes happening in their psyches or minds, such as the deeply personal and subjective changes that occur as well. People emerge with a new sense of purpose and or meaningfulness in their lives from just doing wilderness retreats. All over the world, there are people who have gifts that share these. One of the greatest gifts that has been completely misunderstood was that of Bannister. Every scientist, mechanical engineer, everyone said that the human body cannot run faster than a four-minute mile. He did 3:58, and suddenly multiple other people broke his record. What were they waiting for? The belief that it could be done. Now, every doctor in the United States, whether it's an oncologist, gastroenterologist, cardiologist, neurologist, when you go into that person's office, they're going to ask you, how are you doing? Let's say that they've taken medication or they're recovering from surgery. How are you feeling? Now, here's the contradiction, and this shows the gross contradiction, that if you say that what a person gives you in the way of feedback is anecdotal and therefore of no scientific value, then why are you asking them how they're doing? Why don't you just make the assumption, I gave you a drug, you had a medical procedure, you had radiation, you had chemotherapy, you had a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, you should be doing fine because the science is perfect. Therefore, your opinion of how this is working in the body is subjective and therefore anecdotal and of no value. That means that we wouldn't have to communicate with the doctor. We would simply assume that every medical procedure is of value because they have science on their side. They wouldn't be giving us something that wasn't scientifically proven. And yet just the opposite is the truth, that number one cause of death in the United States and injury is iatrogenesis, or medically induced. I wrote a paper on it, took 5 years of research. It's called medical genocide. And it shows that more people die because of errors in medical practice than heart disease or stroke or cancer. And yet there is no questioning ever the cancer protocols, the heart disease protocols, and as you mentioned earlier, the psychiatric protocols. Would you comment on this reductionist scientific mindset?
Well, I will add to, just as a compliment to what you just said, this may be a bit controversial, I'm about to say, but I would say a major cause of depression in the modern world is the institutions of mental health that reduce, like the National Institute of Mental Health. It is, what is more profoundly depressing than to be told, as Eric Kandel, a Nobel laureate and a neuropsychiatrist, states, that you are in no way responsible for your depression. Your depression and any other distress you have, any other disease, is solely a dysfunction of your brain. And you're not responsible for anything, because the brain is the agent. You might think you're the agent. You might think your mind is agent of your creativity, your desires, aspirations and ideals of finding a meaningful life. But your mind isn't agent. And you as a human being, you're not the agent. The brain is the agent, and it does everything, and you're just along for the ride. And whatever distress you're feeling is solely as a result of your brain, and your brain is a physical organism that is influenced solely by other physical phenomena according to the amoral and mindless laws of physics, chemistry, and biology. If you're not depressed, if you believe that, then you're just not paying attention. So major cause of depression in the modern world and of anxiety, general anxiety disorder, I would say is the view of the human mind and mental health by the medical profession. Because what's more depressing than that? You're not even an agent. You have no control. And the only hope you have is taking, for example, for depression, taking antidepressants, which often don't work at all. And if they do work, they'll probably poop out after a couple of years. And then you'll have side effects from getting off the depression, the antidepressant. And moreover, you may need another drug to deal with the side effects of the depressant, antidepressant. And that goes also for treatment for ADHD, for general anxiety disorder, for insomnia, and so forth. So this is a profoundly debilitating, disempowering, dehumanizing, and demoralizing view of human existence and the human mind. What is more depressing than that? And if you believe that worldview, and you go to a psychiatrist and say, I'm feeling profoundly depressed because I'm finding life is meaningless, they're going to give you a drug. And if it doesn't work, well, that's even more depressing. And so, as William James said, scientific materialism always ends in tragedy. I think it's pretty much a verbatim quote. It always ends in tragedy. Because it tells you, according to Stephen Jay Gould, the great biologist, evolutionary biologist, and I paraphrase closely here, evolution is meaningless, pointless, and purely physical. The notion that all of human evolution has taken place only because of genetic mutation and natural selection, and there are no other influences at all. Now, that's a metaphysical belief. That is not a scientific conclusion. But then we're told, as Stephen Hawking says, we human beings, we are chemical scum on the surface of a moderate-sized planet in a suburb of a moderate-sized galaxy in a mindless universe, an amoral universe, and that's the universe at large. And then biologically speaking, evolution is meaningless. And then individually speaking, you're not even an agent. You're not, in fact, you probably don't exist at all. You're just a fiction of your brain's imagination. And so this is absolutely catastrophic. And it cannot be isolated. This worldview of materialism that simply reduces all of reality to configurations of matter and energy that are influenced only by configurations of matter and energy, not the kind of energy you talk about, but kind of energy that you learn about in physics classes in universities all over the world.
Alan, unfortunately, we're out of time. The hour is gone. Thank you so much, Dr. Alan Wallace, for being on and talking about the difference between consciousness, the mind, and brain. I appreciate it very much.
It's been a privilege to join you, Gary. Thank you.
For all of you listening, thank you for being on board. Look forward to sharing more on the next program. Have a nice day.